Good. Welcome to the mentoring lunch. As you know, one of the rules of this mentoring lunch is a rule of impoliteness being imposed on you, which is that you should eat while I'm talking, and you even should continue eating while our very distinguished guest is speaking. This is not only a mentoring event, but this also is our annual Blackman Lecture. We're grateful to Professor Sharon Davies for instigating the lecture and for the organization by our five former clerks for U.S. Justice Harry Blackman. And I'm going to ask them to stand now, Professor Jim Brudney, Professor Ellen Deason, Professor Ned Foley, Professor Alan Michaels, and Professor Michelle Alexander. They also have organized in connection with this event, which honors the many contributions of Justice Blackman, an opportunity for a student to study Justice Blackman's paper and to do some scholarship in that respect. Also want to thank the Criminal Law Journal, which is a co-sponsor of the Blackman Lecture. And it is especially appropriate today that we bring someone who shares Justice Blackman's great interest in the area of sentencing law. Because we have brought someone from the federal bench, a distinguished member, we are very fortunate to have, in addition to our mentors, several members of the federal bench here visiting. If I could introduce Judge Jeff Sutton, Judge Ed Sargas, Judge Monty Marbley, and from the state bench, I see Judge Bessie, Judge Brown, Judge Reese. Am I missing? Yes, Judge Brown, stand, and Judge Reese I saw come in. Judge Elias. Yeah, I say welcome, and Judge Bessie. So thank you very much for joining us. Judge Nancy Gertner is a graduate of Yale Law School, also has a master's from Yale, and after that clerked on the Seventh Circuit. She has practiced law for 22 years and then been on the bench for 12. Unusual in the sense that her honors come not only from the practicing bar, but also from academia. She has managed in a brilliant way to bridge both of those worlds throughout her career of practice in the areas of criminal law and also civil rights, but also as a member of the federal bench, so that the profession has honored her with this wonderful award, the Massachusetts Bar Foundation, the Great Friend of Justice Award, which I particularly love. But she also has been voted by the lawyers who are readers of the Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly as the best federal judge in Boston. And that organization gave her the Judge Toomey Judicial Excellence Award. She also has been honored by that publication as one of the most influential practitioners of law. And on the academic side, she has been a visiting professor at Harvard Law School, as well as the University of Arizona Law School, and also has taught at Yale, Boston University, Boston College, and has received honorary degrees from Suffolk and Northeastern Schools of Law. It's a very great pleasure to welcome back a classmate of mine from law school and a very distinguished member of the federal bench, Judge Nancy Gertner.
It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm told that I should once again tell you that you should continue to eat. But from my family traditions, I'm Jewish, the notion of eating and talking comes very easily. I was going to bring up a plate, but I thought it would be disruptive. It's really a pleasure to be here and to be in this setting. I've had the pleasure of sitting next to Justice Blackman during what we describe as the teenage judge session. There's a baby judge school and a teenage judge school. It was an extraordinary pleasure because he worries but about the struggle of the job, about dealing with issues about which people felt deeply, about dealing with colleagues, about dealing with the public, and grappling with all of that in the mix of being a judge. In the area that I teach and work, which is sentencing, his decision in United States versus Mistretta, which upheld the constitutionality of the guidelines, was clearly a watershed opinion. As I read it now, I realize that an important part of what he was doing, a premise of the decision, was that there would be a vigorous, robust judiciary that would help the guidelines evolve, a sentencing commission in the judicial branch that would, like the judges, be totally independent of the political winds, and that their independence would come from their unique sentencing expertise, and that Congress would allow this synergy between an independent and robust judiciary and a commission evolve. The premises were completely wrong for reasons that he could not have known and never anticipated. The judiciary failed him and us. And that's really the subject of my talk, and it's wonderful to have so many judges in the audience. There are many things to be said about the federal sentencing guideline, most of which have been said by Doug Berman. They have dramatically increased an already legendary incarceration rate in combination with other factors. They've tripled prison terms. They've resulted in a wildly disproportionate imprisonment of African Americans. And they have transformed the sentencing process and in some ways made it less transparent and to a degree less fair. But my topic, and I love the opportunity to be able to talk about this and crystallize this, my topic is different. It's not the impact of the federal sentencing guidelines on the defendants, which is considerable, or on defense lawyers or prosecutors or even prisons, but rather the impact on judges and the process of judging. It's an area that I have only begun to appreciate in detail. The change, just broadly stated, is a change from the view that sentencing was in a judge's unique area of competence to its opposite. Hence the title, From Omnipotence to Impotence in 20 Short Years. I have to say as a caveat that I gave this talk in Australia, and I had an audience of people who weren't quite sure what I was talking about. But in any event, let me frame the discussion sort of generally. It is, and it's a, on the one hand, a cautionary tale about sentencing, but I think it actually has implications broader than that. There were three periods in American sentencing, three modern periods. In the first period, prior to the 1980s, American judges, like judges around the world, believed that sentencing was their area of special competence. We called this was the indeterminate sentencing period. Sentences could be set anywhere within the broad ranges outlined by Congress. In fact, judges believed that they were so skilled in sentencing that they resisted all efforts to restrict their discretion, even opposing proposals for appellate review of sentences. In commonwealth countries around the world, there has been appellate review of sentences, even when there were no externally imposed guidelines. But American judges resisted that. They waxed indignant on the subject of any external sentencing restrictions. Sentencing was, in fact, a pillar of judicial independence. So strongly did judges feel about this that in 1987, when the sentencing guidelines were enacted, 200 judges declared them unconstitutional. Over the next 18 years, and despite this principled and robust opposition, something remarkable happened. Common law judges, and that's what we were, American common law judges, enforced the sentencing guidelines with a rigor not at all required by the text of the statute or its legislative history. This, by the way, included judges at all levels. If you envision guidelines on a continuum from advisory to mandatory, this is the period when judicial decisions, not the Congress so much, judicial decisions led to a slide from voluntary to mandatory, much to the chagrin of many of the original reformers. More recently, since United States v. Booker, when the guidelines were declared advisory, the trends that had been lurking before Booker continued. In an extraordinary development again, federal judges, notwithstanding this rich 200-year history of sentencing, came to believe, and I have quotes of judges who have said this, both in their writings and in panels, that they were not competent to sentence at all, absent precise guidelines externally promulgated by a Congress or an expert agency. they were not able to produce, they believed, judicial guidelines. So at a time of greater discretion, the loosening of the federal sentencing guidelines, judges have willingly conceded that the advisory guidelines are entitled to considerable, even presumptive weight, announcing that Congress and the Sentencing Commission have far greater expertise than the judiciary. Indeed, some are now lobbying to tighten the sentencing rules, further restricting their own discretion. I don't think that I have seen in any other area as a remarkable a shift in judicial attitudes as this, especially, as I said, with respect to sentencing, which had always been the area of unique discretion for judges. And thus, it's clearly worth studying. Why the shift from omnipotence to impotence? What lessons does it teach us? What cautionary tale does it tell us? How did it happen? Does it predict the same things happening in other areas? I won't go on in that direction. Otherwise, we'll be here for lunch and dinner. So I'll just focus on my more narrow topic. First, there are many reasons, external reasons, that may be one can advance for this change from the way federal judges deal with sentencing. There are external reasons, and I just want to lay them out. First is the popular punitiveness, as the experts like to describe it. With a crime by the Dukakis-Bush campaign became the fodder of political campaigns, 24/7 news coverage, and that actually had not been as much the case before 1990, and that set up a political pressure on judges which cannot be denied. In one sense, one explanation for why the guidelines had this extraordinary impact is that it was much easier to say, you know, the guidelines made me do it, than to take responsibility for your decision. So I don't want to minimize the climate, political climate in which these decisions were made. Then there's other scholars have written about the administrative state. Sentencing has become sort of the last area in which administrative regulations, the common law process was overtaken by administrative regulations. So that is one factor. Then there are profoundly anti-judge attitudes which slid into anti-discretion attitudes. The notion that judges should exercise evaluative judgment has been the subject, it seems to me, of criticism in a number of areas, and sentencing was no different. I was reminded of a wonderful comment that had been made by Roscoe Pound. He saw the movement of law as a pendulum swinging from excessive certainty to excessive discretion and back. By the early 1990s, he noted, the pendulum had swung too far in the direction of the certainty and the mechanical, and over the next numbers of years, the pendulum went in the other direction, and he was part of the reason for that. So there has been sort of a swinging sense of what, there's been a pendulum as to the relationship between judicial discretion and rules. Sentencing has also changed in regard to these pressures, an emphasis on retribution rather than rehabilitation. And when the emphasis is on retribution, who the experts are at retribution can change. And one can argue that when you're talking about retribution, experts in that are more likely to be Congress and the elected branches than judges. And so as the purposes of sentencing began to shift, it would not be illegitimate that this notion of what judges were expert at would shift as well. But I don't want to focus on the external issues. I want to focus for a moment at the choices that judges made in interpreting the federal sentencing guidelines and the choices that the commission made. What is so unique about this is that even as the pendulum slid from judicial discretion and the formalism and back again over American history, sentencing was always different. Sentencing was always an island of discretion, notwithstanding what else was going on. In fact, across the world, in all common law countries, in all civil code countries, and even in communist countries, sentencing was always a discretionary moment. It is quite in civil code countries, which are so different from ours in many of the ways that they deal with statutes and texts and judges. Nevertheless, sentencing was a moment of discretion. That's why I want to talk about this period. So, broadly speaking, there were three periods, and I want to look at that again. First was the indeterminate sentencing period, when the purpose of sentencing was rehabilitation. And if that's your purpose, then a different idea of who would be the expert in that flowed. the judge was seen as the expert in individualizing a sentence to reflect the goals of punishment. The judge was like a physician. His goal was therapeutic. I should say his or her goal was therapeutic. Different standards evolved between the trial stage and the sentencing stage, and that made sense. The trial stage was all about rights and formalities. The sentencing stage was all about discretion. It makes sense. The judge needed to hear every piece of information in the same way that a doctor making a clinical judgment need to hear everything. You know, one would have rules saying, I'm sorry, doctor, you can't pay attention to my, you know, horned toe because that's out of the bounds of what we're allowing you to talk about. When the model was clinical, therapeutic, rehabilitative, it followed that the standards of proof and the concept of expertise was different. Congress had, to some degree, a lesser role because it had no expertise in rehabilitation. Rehabilitation is classically individual. Congress could set broad retribution goals but could not apply them to the individual case. Occasionally, Congress would intervene, that is to say, increase a punishment, or the police would intervene in the middle. But for the most part, the judge, everyone, Congress, everyone believed that judges were, this was an area where judges had unique competence. The problem was, and I practiced during this period of time, judges' competence and expertise in sentencing, I would agree, was to a degree mythological, right? The judge, and I see this more as I travel around the world, no one was trained to exercise the discretion they had. There were no courses about sentencing in law school. Criminal procedure was always taught as if the enterprise began with the charge and ended with the verdict. There were no courses about rehabilitation, deterrence, anything about what made a particular sentence more efficacious than another. Part of it was the failure of research. There were no meaningful, good studies about what worked, what sentencing alternatives affected rehabilitation or even meaningful deterrence. There were no good statistics. The way I like to describe this is it was like judges were functioning as diagnosticians without any authoritative texts, like surgeons without Gray's Anatomy. There was no peer review, right? There were no rounds. You had sentencing rounds where other judges would say, gee, I would have done something different. All efforts to come up with peer review had in fact failed. And most significantly, and this is, as I said, a critique of this omnipotence phase, there was no appellate review of sentencing. In Australia, where I spoke this summer, and England and Canada, although there had been no guidelines, there had been, and Israel, there had been a rich tradition of appellate review of sentencing. And what happened with respect to sentencing is what happened with respect to torts and contracts and other areas, which is when you're asked what your reasons were, which is what a court of appeals does, you gave them. And so the sentencing judges had to articulate their reasons, and what followed was a body of law. You can have problems with it, you could agree with it or disagree with it, but a body of law about what kinds of reasons worked, what kinds of reasons didn't. Without appellate review, few judges bothered to write sentencing opinions at all, much less any reasoned decisions on the subject. If you weren't asked, you don't answer. Nor was there any meaningful sentencing advocacy. So there was no question that the period of so-called omnipotence had its problems, and one problem was clearly that as a result of that, there was wide disparity across the country in sentencing, not, by the way, nearly as substantial as some would allow you to believe, but there certainly was disparity across the country. There were those who believed they had a right to say, I don't believe in the drug laws, or I don't believe in the draft laws, judges who sentenced based on premises which were not widely accepted. And that certainly led to what Judge Frankel described as an unruliness, the absence of rational ordering, the unbridled power of sentences to be arbitrary and discriminatory, and the latter was particularly significant. There was unquestionably a tendency to punish African-American offenders more severely than white offenders. So this was not nirvana, this period of omnipotence. From my perspective, it was also not nirvana because it was irrational in a different way that had nothing to do with the disparity problem. It was irrational because no one was really focusing on what works, what made sense, what alternatives were efficacious. And even if you were concerned about retribution, there was no consistent focus on proportionality and the rules for proportionality. So it was a problem. The Sentencing Reform Act was the product of that concern, the disparity concern, not the other concerns. The Sentencing Reform Act, essentially, what the Sentencing Reform Act did is to say that within the broad ranges that had been set by Congress, because there had been no effort to change the federal criminal code, a sentencing commission would be formed that would come up with guidelines within those broad ranges. It was very interesting. The Sentencing Commission is very interesting. One could address disparity just by coming up with generalizations. In other words, well, I'll tell you what the average sentences are. You could deal with disparity. Tell me what the average sentences are. We'll make them guidelines, and then you dovetail your sentence to that. But the commission was more than just a codifier. At least it was supposed to be more than just a codifier. The commission was supposed to take into account scientific criminology, to reflect the, quote, latest scientific studies in effectuating the purposes of punishment, to do the kind of legwork that Congress had been unable to do and is not really within the ken of the judiciary to do. The commission was to be also to deal with limited retribution. It was to be an expert at limited retribution, not coming up with what the public might believe this crime deserves, but rather initially dealing with ranking crimes relative to one another, trying to understand how Congress had done that so that there would be a rational ordering of crimes. It could have gone in two directions. Like all legislation in this country, it had, in fact, the tendency to go in two directions. One view was that the commission's expertise would not supplant the judge's expertise. Judges would be authorized to depart from the guidelines whenever they concluded there was a factor, quote, of a kind or to a degree not taken into account by the Sentencing Commission. And since the Sentencing Commission at the outset recognized it couldn't take into account all factors, arguably that really was an opening for judges to remain essentially as parallel experts, the expert Sentencing Commission and the expert judges. There was another way that they could have gone, which is in fact the way it went, which is that the guidelines were mandatory, that the Sentencing Commission shaped, essentially took over the field of sentencing, and that judges were just applying it. What one could have anticipated from this rich and robust omnipotence tradition was a vibrant effort of judges to interpret the guidelines. You look at every other, those of you who do criminal law, you look at every other area. When racketeering laws were passed, there was debate about what they meant. Are they overbroad? What does this word mean? In other areas of substantive criminal law, there was a rich debate in which federal judges participated in the interpretive process. And we would have expected that with respect to sentencing, given this earlier tradition, given the fact that 200 judges declared it unconstitutional, large numbers testified against the guidelines or spoke out in law reviews. When the guidelines were first implemented, the Sentencing Commission didn't post on their website, but issued statistics as to judicial compliance with the guidelines. In other words, if you departed from the guideline structure, there would be, they would call it non-compliance. There was a huge outcry. It's not compliance. Judges were parallel experts, and when they departed, it was helped. The Sentencing Commission would look at that. It would be one way that the guidelines would evolve. But even in the early years of the guidelines, and as time went on, there was a sea change. Again, quoting Professor Berman, federal judges were passive in their sentencing decision-making, marginalized themselves from the process of interpreting this new document. Let me give you a few examples of what could have been done. Again, the Sentencing Commission acknowledged that it was not dealing with every imaginable situation. They could not. Sentencing guidelines were promulgated in essentially a year. There was virtually no hearings with respect to them. So it would make sense that it would be a rough cut. And one could imagine common law evolving in the interstices of the guidelines. That was one way of where the common law might develop. Well, gee, Commission, you didn't really deal with this issue that I have in front of me. There was an administrative law model. In every other area of American law where there's an administrative body, there is still a robust judicial review. Does this regulation, is it rationally related to the purposes of the statute? Is there a basis in fact for it? And then quite apart from administrative law and quite apart from common law rulemaking in the interstices of the guidelines, we never believed as common law judges that words enforce themselves. We always believe that they ought to be interpreted. Words like vulnerable victim, concepts like extraordinary family circumstances were subject to be interpreted by federal judges. But there was no common law that evolved to all intents and purposes, except for me and a couple of others, people who wrote. Judges who had formally opposed the guidelines intoned, the guidelines made me feel like an accountant. It may make no sense, but I'm obliged to enforce it. Common law judges that had no problem interpreting other statutory provisions interpreted these provisions robotically. The question is why? And that's really the core of what I have been struggling with for the past 12 years since I've been on the bench. How did this happen? First, there are really three issues. One is what I call the tabula rasa, which is the impact of sentencing guidelines on this period of omnipotence when there really was no coherent theory of sentencing. So the impact of guidelines on what was essentially this tabula rasa. The second issue is the 300-pound gorilla, which was the sentencing guideline book, 300 pages of a code that purported to cover everything, had an impact on sentencing. And then what evolved from that was very interesting to me, which was almost an ideology like a civil code ideology. American common law judges began to behave like civil code judges, and I'll explain that in a minute. So the tabula rasa, judges then approached the guidelines without really having spent the previous 200 years coming up with a coherent theory of sentencing, appellate review, a body of law. And into that comes numerical guidelines. A student of mine did a fabulous paper on the concept of anchoring, the psychological concept of anchoring, which is a strategy used to simplify complex tasks where numeric judgments are assimilated to a previously considered standard. And the cognitive psychological literature talks about how powerful numbers are and the extent to which they essentially shape thinking. There was a wonderful story about if I divided the room in half and I say to part of the room, I have a bottle of wine here, the charge is, it'll cost anywhere from $1 to $5, one part of the room would say, oh, four. If I say, I have a bottle of wine here, the cost is anywhere from 60 to 1,000, you'll have an entirely different, it's not so much staying within the, and I'll tell you that the guidelines are voluntary. You don't have to go, you can go anywhere, but the odds are you'll be drawn to the numbers. And so on this tabula rasa, this incredibly complex grid had a power beyond what anyone would have anticipated. And then there's the ideology of sentencing, of the civil code, which is the one that has particularly intrigued me. This was the subject of an article I was going to write before Booker. I was on my way to Turkey, and I was asked to read the book by a man named Merriman called The Civil Code. And I read the book. I was supposed to be thinking about the Turkish civil code system, and as I read it, I said, oh my God, these are the sentencing guidelines. You get on a track, and that's all you can think about. Merriman said, in the civil code countries, the judge becomes an expert clerk. His function is merely to find the right legislative provision, couple it with the fact situation, and bless the solution that is more or less automatically produced from the union. The whole process of judicial decision is made to fit into the formal syllogism of scholastic logic. The major premise is the statute, the facts of the case are the minor premise, and the conclusion inevitably follows. So in a civil code country, the premises were that the code is comprehensive, the work of experts, that there were no gaps in it, and if there were, the experts would fill them, and all the judge had to do is apply the words. And that's what the ideology that grew over the past 18 years is that's what the sentencing guidelines were. And although this is there's disagreement in these areas, I want to offer my perception that those premises are flawed. The guidelines were not intended to be and could never be comprehensive. There were gaps which the drafters acknowledged, which the legislative history makes clear. And of course, that makes enormous sense. Coming up with national guidelines for a complex, heterogeneous country like ours is not easy. They were supposed to be drafted by sentencing experts, but they were not. The commission never did what it was supposed to do. The guidelines that resulted from its work were a patchwork quilt of compromises, often rushed to meet artificial congressional deadlines. There was really, to the extent that the guidelines were supposed to be based on scientific data, the data that they relied on was not penological studies about efficacy or anything like that, but just studies of average sentencing lengths. And even those were not followed, because in many areas, they began with what the sentencing patterns were and increased them. They calculated the average length of sentences in the United States and then increased them. They didn't look closely at what judges actually were doing. That was not easy to do at the time, I agree. They simply compared gross sentencing outcomes and then decided what factors must have been significant. So these were the experts that supplanted the judicial, albeit flawed, judicial experts. The commission, in addition, invented new standards for sentencing, a whole new vocabulary. I've had to deal with what does extensive organization mean. And as an example I love to give, you can increase someone's sentence for extensive organization. And a judge and I on the opposite sides of the building in Boston had a very similar case of a man who went across state borders and set up a prostitution ring. And she had the question, ironically, the two women judges of three in the district, she had the question of whether to increase for extensive organization, as did I. She said, well, to set up this prostitution ring, he had to go back and forth several times, he had to figure out how to wire money, he had to work out where the women were going to stay, extensive organization. Maybe because I had been teaching for such a long time and I'm uncomfortable with looking at a word and assuming that I immediately understand its context, I said, well, extensive organization, why do we penalize extensive organization more? What is it that made, well, maybe there's something in conspiracy law, and I looked at the traditional concepts of conspiracy law that made us look at organizations differently than otherwise. And I came to the conclusion that a couple of trips across the border and setting up the hotel was not an extensive organization. Now, I did this not based on what the sentencing guidelines had no legislative history, so I couldn't reach into that as I could have in interpreting anything else. They simply used the word extensive organization. They invented their own standards, their own words. There were minimal hearings, no legislative history, no way of judging context, which of course drew judges then into looking at the word out of the context of anything else. There was no meaningful review of guidelines under the Administrative Procedure Act. In fact, we spend more time scrutinizing the rationale of rules concerning snail darters in environmental regulations than we do rules with respect to liberty. Too often, the commission did just what Congress did. It took the sentences proposed by one side and split the difference. Over and over again, the commission opted to minimize judicial discretion, trying to focus on factors that were quantitative, that would be objectively determined, rather than looking at social background, medical, psychological condition. And then of all the purposes that were still in the Sentencing Reform Act, it's clear that the only purpose that the commission paid attention to was disparity, because there were no hearings that talked about anything else. There was no rationale for why setting this numerical threshold was related to any of the other purposes of sentencing. In short, this was not the high-minded commission with expertise in penology, deterrence, rehabilitation. It is what Justice Scalia described as the junior varsity Congress, political from the outset, largely responding to public pressures. But notwithstanding all of that, the ideology persisted. that the guidelines were comprehensive, that these were experts and we are not, that whatever gaps in the guidelines were to be filled not by the common law approach, but by those experts, the commission, that the judges were clerks. And when the guidelines were declared to be advisory under Booker, small wonder, virtually nothing changed. Virtually nothing changed. To all intents and purposes, the judges have been continued to do what they have done before. And the guy, let me spend a moment, to some degree, Booker made perfect sense to me, although it made sense to a lot of people it didn't make sense to. And it made sense to me because when the guidelines were, before the guidelines, when we had indeterminate, albeit flawed sentencing, when the judge was this clinical expert, what the judge was doing and what the jury was doing was very different. The jury was finding facts with determinate consequences, whereas the judge was exercising judgment. Clinical judgment, flawed, but clinical judgment. As the guidelines that the judges were imposing became mandatory over time, all the judge was doing was exactly what the jury was doing. And the ceremony was very different. The judge was finding facts with determinate consequences. You tally up the figures and you come up with a conclusion. And so Booker made entire sense to me. If the guidelines were mandatory, then we had taken away substantial amounts from the jury. Justice Breyer, in his extraordinary opinion, remedial opinion in Booker, understood then that the way to take away the constitutional problem was to restore at least some of the advisoriness discretionary guidelines. But the problem is, nothing's changed. Let me footnote, very little has changed. The sentences are completely, the enormous power of the grid continues. Sentences are anchored, as the cognitive psychologists describe, in the guidelines, because there was no alternative formulation. You're drawn to this framework because there was no alternative framework. The civil code ideology persists, that the guidelines have considered all the that the commission has considered all the purposes of sentencing. All you have to do is plug in your case. Deviation from the guidelines is rarely appropriate and only for good reasons. The result of all of this is one judge whom I respect enormously who said in a decision, quote, "We are likely to muck things up," he said, "about federal judges if we do our own thing. Unlike Congress or the Commission, we judges lack the institutional capacity and, frankly, the personal competence to set and then enforce new, theoretically coherent national standards, as opposed to the uniform, albeit flawed, guidelines. It would make things far worse if different judges have different standards." In this case, he was dealing with crack sentencing. Let me unpack that for a moment. The question of coming up with national standards, if you're talking about institutional capacity to deal with retribution, the kinds of national standards which are what retributive standards are more likely to be national standards, you're saying this offense, quite apart from this offender, deserves X or Y. In a common law setting, as in Australia, Israel, Canada, England, what happened was that the common law, if my reasoning was persuasive, it would become the national standard. If the First Circuit said something interesting about sentencing and buttressed it with reasons, it would become the national standard. We never had trouble with common law articulation of national standards in any other setting. On the question then of rehabilitation, again, the notion that any expertise resides in the commission that has really not dealt with any of these kinds of issues doesn't make any sense, or Congress, which understood it couldn't individualize. There was no confidence any longer in sentencing in the expertise of judges. Now, we've seen this in other areas, and in my spare time, I want to look at other areas as well. There's a competence discussion with respect to national security issues. Judges are not competent to address national security issues. Again, there's a debate about that. Israel, the Israeli Supreme Court, daily deals with national security issues. There are no justiciability limits in Israel. There's no standing limits. They deal with national security. Competence issues also have come up in affirmative action cases, some notion that judges can't, well, there it's more of a notion of legitimacy, that somehow it's not legitimate for judges to venture into this area. Sometimes competence means you don't have training, sometimes competence means it's a political question. Judges, unelected judges, should not go near that. But it seems to me sentencing is different. If the issue is competency as legitimacy, it seems to me we have 200 years of legitimacy and the standards of judges around the world with respect to that. If the issue is competency as training, there was a way to address that. There continues to be a way to address that. If the issue is competency as a political legitimacy issue, that is an interesting question. Congress certainly has an important role in determining what the moral values are that frame the criminal code, a central role in that. But with all respect, the commission is unelected as well. And the notion that their competence should supplant mine is an interesting one. In any event, what I want to leave you with is this. Whatever else the guidelines have done, they have to some degree sucked out the creativity of the bench, the feeling that the bench could deal with this area that had been uniquely theirs. I hear judges complaining that sentencing is now taking too long. There are too many sentencing hearings because even if you're doing a guideline sentence, as most of them wind up doing, you still have to address these issues. And I say to them, how long do you spend on a summary judgment in a patent case? How long do you spend on a summary judgment in a discrimination case? How many hearings do you have in these other areas? The old story about omnipotence has met the new story about impotence, which is that we were not paying enough attention before, we're not paying enough attention now. We have gotten used to sentencing being whatever we talked about in those first flawed periods. We talked about it in grandiose terms, but what we did was perfunctory. And today, that continues. Only the outcome of it today, I think, is, I won't say worse, but as bad, which is a national rigor mortis with respect to sentencing. Sentencing, which is essentially enforced with a ceremony of sentencing, is not about justice and fairness and retribution and rehabilitation to all intents and purposes. It continues to be about numbers. I want to end with a story about the Israeli Supreme Court again, because I think it sort of summarizes what I hope would be a new discussion about judges and sentencing. I visited Jerusalem at a time when Aharon Barak was dealing with the wall between Israel and the territories. And I came into his lobby, and he had a mock-up of the wall there. And I said, Aharon, how in creation, how do you know anything about this implicit? How do you have the competence to deal with this? What are you talking about? And he said to me in his inimitable fashion, well, I don't know anything about national security, but I know about proportionality. I know that's my unique expertise. You tell me what your security issues are, and I can address proportionality. Now, I'm not advocating that for the United States. We have a very different history. But the notion that I can't deal with proportionality, that I don't have the expertise to individualize justice, is a very troubling issue, a very troubling concept. And I would hope that after this talk, it all changes. Thank you very much.
well, the question for all of you is whether after this talk it should all change. Because we have some students who have to leave shortly, what we'll do is we'll for those of you who can stay long enough, we'll be calling on the tables to get your answer to that question. So discuss it at the tables, and we'll be back. Judge Gertner will be back up here to hear you.
Yeah.